Chapter 7. Agree on a plan and follow up. How to gain commitment and move to action. By now you've done a lot of work. You noted a problem and decided that the gap was worth confronting. You told yourself the whole story and took care to step up to the right issue. You then worked hard to deal with both motivation and ability issues. You even dealt with a new problem, used your bookmark, and then solved the original problem. Jointly, you found solutions that seemed promising. Good job. But don't exhale too quickly. The way you complete a crucial confrontation is as important as the way you started. If you do this well, you build commitment and establish a foundation for accountability. If you don't finish the job, if you swap your backbone for a wishbone, you set yourself up for a whole new set of problems. Let's look at some of these challenges and then explore the skills and tools master influencers use to plan and follow up. Predictable problems. Certain problems are so common that after you hear no more than a sentence and a half, the whole messy situation comes to mind. For instance, see how long it takes before you can identify where these common problems are headed. How good is your crystal ball? At the end of last week's meeting, Jane said to Joe, "So you'll get the report done?"
"Absolutely,"
Joe exclaimed, mentally figuring how to fit another assignment onto a plateful of tasks so overflowing that it was starting to interfere with his bowling. A week passes, and Jane is at the door.
"I needed that report yesterday afternoon. Can I have it now?"
"Now? I had that scheduled for next week," Joe laments.
Jane responds by rolling her eyes.
"You must have known I needed it."
Joe hates that eye thing and responds under his breath, "My crystal ball was at the cleaners."
"What was that?"
Jane asks, raising her voice.
"Nothing," Joe grunts.
"You said something," Jane accuses him.
"I said, my eye is on the ball, and I mean it,"
Joe lies. What exactly is creativity? During a formal review discussion, Barb talked to her direct report, Johnson, about being more creative. Her exact words were,
"During the next quarter, I want you to use more creativity. You know, come up with more ideas on your own."
In an effort to be more creative, Johnson did indeed come up with more ideas on his own, just as he was asked to. That was the good news. The bad news was that he also implemented many of his ideas without involving Barb or anyone else. He interpreted the request to be more creative as permission to do pretty much whatever he pleased. When Barb eventually learned that Johnson had changed the company's entire inventory system and hadn't given her so much as a heads up, she blew a gasket and told him that he had gone well beyond his authority. He responded by arguing that he was just trying to be more creative, and now she was taking him to task for doing what she had asked him to do all along. Must we play word games? Dad is stewing. It's a sultry summer night, and for the last hour and a half he has been staring at the clock. During that time, he has tried very hard not to get angry. It's now 1:24 a.m., and his daughter opens the door. Dad shouts,
"Shelley, you're really late!"
"No, I'm not, Dad. Last week, my friend Sarah didn't come home until 9 the next morning. That's really late."
"Don't be smart-mouthed with me," Dad retorts. "You're supposed to be in by midnight, and you've been coming in late all month."
"You're right," Shelley says with a sly smile. "I have been coming in at about 1 a.m. for a month ever since my birthday, and you haven't said one thing about it at all until now. I thought it was okay."
Dad comes back with his best quip.
Don't assume.
How long did it take before you recognized the problem in these examples? Jane and Joe made a sketchy plan. Without agreeing on a specific deadline, that plan was doomed from the get-go. They had to play read my mind or take my best guess. Johnson and Barb faced a different problem. The assignment included who was going to do what by when, but the details about the what were not clear. She told him to be creative, but that term is far too subjective. Once again, an accident waiting to happen. Finally, Dad and daughter represent still another issue. By not confronting his daughter for coming in late, following up on a previous agreement, for several days running, he let Shelley assume that what she was doing must have been okay. Like it or not, Dad had given his tacit approval. At least, that was what Shelley thought. The solution: make a plan complete with WWWF. The key to making a complete and clear plan, free from all assumptions and thus improving accountability, is to make sure to include four key components: who, does what, by when, follow up. As we just noted, problems typically arise because assignments have only two or three of these components. Let's look at each of the four and see what the experts have taught us from the trenches. Who? This first issue is the easiest. Someone's name has to be attached to each task. But there's the rub. Someone's name has to be attached. Someone needs to be in charge or accountable. At the end of a meeting, the supervisor says, "Okay, we should get it done by Friday at noon." Come Friday, nothing is done. The boss exclaims, "Where is it?" And the finger-pointing party begins. What? Deciding exactly what you're after can be challenging. Johnson ended his performance review with Barb by accepting the responsibility to be more creative during the next quarter. So they followed the rules, right? It was clear who would do what by when. Not exactly. Barb needed to provide a detailed description of the exact behaviors she was looking for. "By being more creative, I mean I'd like you to come up with more product ideas on your own. I'd love for you to come to our weekly meeting and present new ideas for improvements. The same is true for solutions. When you see a problem, rather than asking what needs to be done, come up with suggestions and then present them to me." Ask. When you end a crucial confrontation and are deciding exactly what to do, don't take the what for granted. Ask if there are any questions about quality or quantity. Ask if everyone has the same characteristics in mind. Ask what might be confusing or unclear that has to be clarified now in advance. Contrast. If you suspect that other people are likely to misunderstand you, use contrasting. "I want you to think of new plans. I don't want you to implement them until we've had a chance to talk, but I do want you to take the initiative to present them." Those of you who have had cataract surgery recently are familiar with the hospital version of this technique. A nurse draws, in magic marker and on your forehead, no less, an arrow over the eyeball that is about to receive the surgery, meaning this eye, not the other one. When the stakes are high, leave nothing to chance. How many wrong surgeries were performed until someone came up with this trick? By when? Time is a concept of our own construction. It comes with specific names and numbers. It's quantifiable and exact. Thus, when it comes to setting follow-up times or deadlines for change, you'd think there would be no room for confusion. But we find a way. For example, consider the expression, "I need it next week." This may be specific. If you are perfectly happy to receive the finished product any time in the next week, you have a clear agreement. Technically, the expression promises nothing before 11:59 p.m. on Saturday. However, if you need it before 5 o'clock p.m. on Friday, say so. If you need it on Wednesday, clarify. If you need it by noon on Wednesday, you get the point. What makes this issue particularly intriguing is that the more urgent the task and the more critical the timing, the more vague the instruction. "This is hot. I need it ASAP." "Get right on it." "Hey, did you hear me? This baby is top priority. I need it yesterday." These terms of urgency are train wrecks waiting to happen. Think of it this way. ASAP, the do-it-yourself ulcer kit. This problem comes up at home, too. The following are statements begging for different interpretations. Don't be late.
I'll get that to you soon.
You need to clean up your mess in the kitchen.
We could be wrong about this, but it seems that teenagers have an amazingly well-developed ability to find the cracks in incomplete plans and use them to their advantage. Clarity helps you fill in the cracks.
Follow-up. Once you've clarified who is supposed to do what and by when, the next step should be obvious. Decide when and how you'll follow up on what's supposed to happen. Perhaps both of you have taken an assignment to do something to resolve the problem, but things have come up. When it comes to problem solving with your direct reports or children, you don't necessarily want to leave them to their own devices, particularly if the task is difficult and the people who have to deliver on the promise are unfamiliar with the territory. By the same token, you don't want to be checking up on people every few hours. Nobody likes that. Micromanagement or abandonment. How frequently you follow up with another person depends on that person's record and the nature of the task. How your actions will be viewed by others depends on your attitude and objective. When it comes to following up, ask yourself, what am I really trying to accomplish? If you don't trust others, your follow-up methods are likely to be seen as audits.
Gotcha.
And nobody likes an audit. Unfortunately, the sense of abandonment people experience at the other end of the follow-up continuum may cause just as many problems. Cutting people loose is certainly more common in today's world of empowerment. Leaders don't want to micromanage. They've felt it, they hate it, and they don't want to deliver it. Micromanaging is bad, and so leaders scarcely follow up at all. Good goal, bad strategy. Other factors also contribute to an excessively hands-off style. Many leaders and parents don't believe they have time to follow up. They give a great deal of freedom to others, even to people who have been fairly unreliable. Nowadays, people in authority spend so much time traveling, answering email, and sitting in meetings that they don't even notice that they don't follow up very often. Unfortunately, this hands-off style is rarely interpreted positively. People don't say,
"I understand. The boss is so busy that he can hardly find time to follow up."
More often than not, employees conclude, "The boss doesn't care about me or my project." Busy parents suffer the same fate. Busyness is interpreted as apathy, and this harms both the relationship and the results. When it comes to how and when you follow up with others, your intentions will have a huge impact. Two forms of follow-up, check-up and check-back. Who initiates the follow-up discussion? Does the person giving the assignment always take the lead, or are there times when the person taking the assignment follows up? Do a check-up when you're giving the assignment and are nervous or have questions. You've looked at the risk, the track record, and the person's experience, and you're feeling anxious or uneasy, even tense. This is the time to use a checkup. You take the lead. Get your PDA or calendar out. Say something like the following. Since this is such an important task, I'm wondering if we could meet next Wednesday at 10 to review how it's going. You write it down. You are in charge of the follow-up. The fact that you're taking the lead doesn't mean that you are micromanaging. It means that you own the follow-up. It can and certainly should mean that you're interested in how the task went, what worked, and what got in the way. If the task is risky enough, the follow-up should be scheduled along the way to make sure that all is going well and that you are available to provide help or coach. Use a check-back when the task is routine and has been assigned to someone who is experienced and productive. Now that person is in charge. That person checks back. He or she offers suggestions. How about meeting at our next scheduled meeting? Or, the deadline is 2 weeks from today. Could we meet next Thursday 15 minutes before our staff meeting to touch base? To achieve the results you want, as well as maintain healthy relationships, both checkups and checkbacks can be useful forms of follow-up. People forget. Our first problem is that we tend to forget. Life is so fast-paced, full, and busy, we can't keep all the balls in the air at the same time. How are we ever going to remember to follow up on all the promises that other people make, or that we make? The answer is that we can't, at least not without help. To keep your promises in front of you, do the following. Put follow-up dates and times on your calendar. Use sticky notes or computer cues to remind yourself. Put follow-up times on your agendas. Reminding yourself to do what is effective is essential in busy environments and times. Families tend to be particularly bad at this. How many people use computers and other electronic devices when giving assignments to children or loved ones? To most of us, that would seem cold and too business-like. Dad, I'm your daughter, not an employee. Nevertheless, the times are changing. Find methods, electronic or other. People worry. Another reason people frequently fail to follow up on assignments is that they want to be seen as nice. As one interviews people in organizations all over the world, it's interesting how frequently the word nice comes up. Question: How would you describe your organization's culture? Response: Nice. In this case, the word has switched meanings from pleasant to disease-like. People want to feel at ease, not stressed. Holding others accountable, particularly if you have to be honest, is stressful. So individuals rationalize and choose niceness over following up. It's not a sellout. Backing off is the right thing to do. Of course, you can believe this semi-tortured logic only if you believe that being honest and holding people to their promises are inherently stressful and bad. Throughout this book, we've tried to make the point that people who confront crucial problems are both candid and courteous. They are honest, but not brutally honest. You can follow up with people and be a decent human being. In fact, the converse is also true. If you don't follow up, you're being unkind to everyone. Allowing failure eventually destroys results and relationships. The tools taught in the preceding chapters are designed to help us be candid and nice, get results and be nice, and follow up and be nice. The scripts you can use for following up are both easy and safe. When you follow up, you ask, "How's the Southland project going?" Or, "We scheduled a follow-up on budget improvements. How's it going?" The purpose of the follow-up is to see what the current status is, how things went, what worked, and what didn't. The intention is to be helpful and supportive. Chapter 8. Put It All Together. How to Solve Big, Sticky, Complicated Problems. Now that we've built our entire crucial confrontations model, let's quickly review each step we covered and then see what the skills look like when applied to a rather big, sticky, complicated problem. This will help us see how a real person during a real confrontation might pick and choose from the toolbox of skills we've been building so carefully. Not all the skills will be needed all the time, and so we must have a way of thinking about which skills apply and when and where. The big idea from each step. Choose what and if. What? Ask yourself what you really want. You can talk about the content, the pattern, or the relationship. To stay focused, ask what you really want. If. Are you talking yourself out of a crucial confrontation? Don't let fear substitute for reason. Think carefully not just about the risks of having the confrontation, but also about the risks of not having it. Master my stories. Instead of assuming the worst and then acting in ways that confirm your story, stop and tell the rest of the story. Ask, why would a reasonable person not do what he or she promised? What role might I have played? When you see the other person as a human being rather than a villain, you're ready to begin. Describe the gap. Make it safe by starting with the facts and describing the gap between what was expected and what was observed. Tentatively share your story only after you've shared your facts. End with a question to help diagnose. Make it motivating and easy. After you've paused to diagnose, listen for motivation and ability. Remember, you don't need power. In fact, power puts you at risk. Instead, make it motivating and make it easy. To do that, explore the 6 sources of influence. Remember to consider others and things as possible influences. Agree on a plan and follow up. Remember who does what by when, and then follow up. This idea is simple and serves as its own reminder. Then ask to make sure you're not leaving out any details or missing any possible barriers. Stay focused and flexible. As other issues come up, don't meander. Consciously choose whether to change the discussion to the new issue. Weigh the new problem. If it's more serious or time-sensitive, deal with it. If it is not, don't get sidetracked. Let's see how all these steps apply to an extended example. Is it you or is it me? For the last 6 months, Ricky has avoided discussing a potential problem with his wife, Elena, because he's worried that he may be at fault. His first wife had cheated on him for a full year before he figured out what was going on. That had rocked him to the core. Not only was he devastated by her infidelity, he reeled at his own inability to spot the early warning signs of something as serious as adultery. Ricky was slow to enter another long-term relationship, once bitten, twice shy. That explains why he dated Elena, a friend from church, for 4 years before convincing himself that his first marriage was a fluke and that Elena was unlike his first wife. Then he took the plunge. After 3 years of marriage to Elena, Ricky fell into a running debate, constantly bickering, with himself. He began to see signs that maybe something bad, even hideous, was going on behind his back, but he wasn't sure if Elena was acting inappropriately or if he was being too suspicious. Thus, Ricky remained silent. Clearly, Elena had changed. She appeared to be more secretive about her email, quickly exiting from it when he entered their home office. She took more phone calls out of the room than ever before. As Elena successfully explained those behaviors, it was job-related and thus uninteresting. A third issue drove Ricky's internal debate to new heights. Elena had begun working a great deal more overtime. This had happened off and on throughout their relationship. But what made extended hours more troubling lately was that her new supervisor was an ex-boyfriend, and some of the late-night work was with him. Let's walk through this delicate, crucial confrontation with Ricky. Read the following sections carefully. 2 times he'll have to step out of the confrontation and restore safety. Choose what and if. Should he confront the gap? Ricky became crystal clear about the need to have a crucial confrontation with Elena when he realized how he and Elena were acting out rather than talking out their problems. His concerns were showing up in a subtle cooling toward Elena. Sensing his withdrawal, she punished him by withdrawing into work. As Ricky considered the clear effect of the absence of conversation on their relationship, he was suddenly certain that he needed to say something. Silence wasn't helping. What does he really want? As Ricky thinks about it, he determines that what he really wants is a loving, warm, and enduring relationship with Elena. He doesn't want to accuse her and drive a bigger wedge into a struggling relationship. What he should do is discuss what is absolutely true. He is worried about their relationship, both about her loyalty and about his paranoia. This is the topic he chooses to take on. Asking what he really wants helps him clarify the issue and avoid spiraling into defensive emotions. Master my stories. Tell the rest of the story. Ricky's first challenge is his own mental state. He strongly suspects that Elena is cheating on him. He's almost certain of it. Furthermore, he is certain that if she is being unfaithful, she will lie to cover it up. That's what happened in his first marriage. It's what guilty people do. Because Ricky is so certain that Elena will lie, his natural tendency is to charge in with an accusation, hoping to startle her into revealing something. He'll be able to tell what's really going on by her reaction. To get his emotions under control, Ricky examines his story. He vigorously attempts to generate alternative explanations for Elena's current behavior. He tells the rest of the story. He does his best to determine why a reasonable, rational, and decent person might do what she's doing. What influences could explain those behaviors beyond the fact that she's a lying, cheating hussy? Here are a few of the other factors Ricky considers as he contemplates all six sources of influence. Ricky knows that Elena has a strong desire to succeed. She is climbing the ladder at work and is willing to pay the price. She may be avoiding talking to him because she worries about having an ugly confrontation. He clearly is contributing. He is taken to making sarcastic comments about the time she spends with her boss. He has been much less affectionate lately. Of course, she finds less joy in being around him. Elena has seemed especially anxious about their expenses. That could be showing up in her acceptance of more overtime. Their work schedules are keeping them from spending much time together. That can't be helping. As Ricky explores alternative explanations, something profound happens to him. He calms down. Of course, he's careful to not let this line of reasoning talk him into blaming himself. His goal is simply to balance the lying, cheating hussy story with other possibilities. He wants to be able to enter the conversation without adrenaline coursing through his veins, turning him into a slavering moron. The effect of this is significant. The new story creates a sense of curiosity and compassion. He begins to hold his suspicions more tentatively. He still wants to talk, but is less inclined to become emotional and leap in with an accusation. Ricky worries that anything he says about a possible affair is likely to make Elena nervous, and so he decides to start by making it safe. He does that by using his two safety tools. He establishes mutual purpose by talking about common ground, and he uses contrasting to clarify any possible misunderstandings. Make it safe. Establish mutual purpose and use contrasting. Here's how Ricky begins the confrontation. Ricky, I have some concerns I'd like to discuss. My worry in raising them is that it'll sound like an accusation, and I don't want that. I notice these concerns are affecting our relationship, and I don't want us to feel distant from each other. I think if we could work this out, it would help us get back to how things were until a few months ago. Would that be all right? Elena, works for me. What's been bugging you? Describe the gap. Once he's done his best to create a safe climate, Ricky tries to describe the gap by starting with the facts and ending with a question. This is how he proceeds. Ricky, well, stay with me for a minute here. This'll take a little telling. He goes on to describe some of the behaviors he saw in his ex-wife and some he is seeing in Elena. As he starts to ask Elena for her point of view, she cuts him off. Elena, I can't believe what I'm hearing. Are you accusing me of cheating on you? You're so paranoid. This just can't work. She starts to leave. Make it safe. Obviously, Elena is acting as if she's still feeling unsafe. Ricky will have to continue using his safety skills, reestablishing mutual purpose and using contrasting. Here is how the confrontation proceeds. Ricky, Elena, I know it might sound paranoid. To be truthful, I don't know what's going on. As I've thought about it, I don't think you're cheating, and I'm sorry to make it sound that way. But I'm seeing enough similarities that I can't not worry. I need to talk this through, both to find out what's really going on, and to find a way to keep my concerns from getting in the way of our relationship. I don't mean to be offensive, but not talking about it won't work for me. Can we please talk? Elena, I'll try. This is pretty hard to listen to. Describe the gap. Once Ricky has done his best to create a safe climate, he finishes the opening lines by asking a question to help diagnose the root causes of the problem. Ricky, Can you see how the behaviors I described would lead someone to worry?
Elena.
I suppose, but you don't need to.
Elena obviously has calmed down and appears ready to discuss the issues honestly.
Ricky.
Well, I'd like to hear how you view what's been going on.
Make it motivating and make it easy. Ricky tries to understand why Elena is spending less time with him and more time at work with her ex-boyfriend. Here's what he learns. Elena has never owed as much money as they currently owe. Her father spent a great deal of time unemployed, and she's anxious about getting behind on their mortgage. She didn't want to bring up the money issue with Ricky because she was afraid that she didn't know how to have the conversation without offending him. Elena is having a very difficult time working for her boss, her ex-boyfriend, because he seems to be punishing her for breaking up with him by being hypercritical of her work. Plus, he's not giving her all the resources she needs. Most late nights, Elena isn't working with him. She works with her team. She's hoping to feel more secure in her job by overperforming. She's been less affectionate with Ricky because she's stressed and tired, and because she's noticed his withdrawal. Ricky and Elena start talking about solutions that might work. For example, perhaps her anxiety would lessen if they dropped their club membership and returned an expensive leased car so that they could start putting away money for a rainy day. She could also look more aggressively at transferring into a less stressful boss-subordinate situation. As the conversation continues, Elena makes the following sarcastic comment and then goes quiet. Elena,
I guess I can do all the sacrificing again.
Stay focused and flexible. Don't meander, choose. Ricky recognizes the new issue and decides to discuss it. Obviously, Elena feels she's being asked to do more than he is doing, and he wants to explore this point.
You're the one who had to make all the accommodations when we first moved here. I didn't realize that was an issue for you. How about if we talk about that and then return to the other topic?
Elena,
I expected you to give up some of your ambitions, too. It's been disappointing that you could just let me do all the giving while you do all the taking.
Agree on a plan and follow up. Decide who does what by when and follow up. After talking for quite some time, working through some issues and jointly exploring solutions, they agree on some changes they'll make, clarifying exactly what each person will do and by when. Then Ricky suggests that they talk about it again at the end of the next week and see how things are working both with his worries and with her feelings of not being supported.
Can people really do this?
A rocket scientist contemplates talking to her boss about a potential safety problem with a new propellant, but chooses not to say a word because she figures that it'll just get her into trouble. For months on end, she walks around in a funk, wondering if something horrible will happen. A nurse wonders about making a suggestion to a doctor that could affect a patient's health, but holds his tongue rather than incur the physician's wrath. As this unspoken interaction continues, he too lives in a cocoon of worry and doubt. A husband chooses not to question his wife about her suspicious behavior and then lives with the haunting possibility that she may be having an affair. And so we're back where we started. We routinely refuse to step up to bad behaviors, despite the fact that they're causing us horrific pain. Because we figure that it's better to suffer in the current circumstances than run the risk of saying something dangerous or stupid. It's a matter of social calculus. Here's the formula. If we speak up, we could fail. We also might do nothing to solve the problem. In fact, we could even create worse problems for ourselves. We do the calculations, and the answer that pops out of our head is HOLDYOURTONGUE. But not forever. We suppress our gripes until one day our dark side shows itself. Our ugly stories create a brew that eventually fuels us with enough energy to take scary actions and dumbs us down enough so that we think that what we're about to do is okay, even the right thing to do.
And so we alternate between silence and violence. First, we think, I can't believe I just said that, and so we shut down. Then we think, I'm not taking this abuse any longer, and so we fire up. This particular cycle might be best described as the social version of quantum mechanics. We jump all the way from silence to violence without ever passing through the intervening space separating the two. We don't pause in the land of dialogue. To us, the lovely place where ideas flow freely and honesty rules doesn't exist. Here's the interesting part. Neither silence nor violence serves us, our relationships, or our purposes, yet we still toggle. The solution to this reaction to failed promises lies in our ability to step up to high-stakes confrontations and handle them well. We see a problem and speak honestly and respectfully. But far more frequently than most of us are willing to admit, like the rocket scientist, the nurse, and the husband, we don't say a word because we don't know how to handle the confrontation or fear that we don't know how. We're not bad people, we're just frightened. And we're not frightened because we are inherently skittish, we're frightened because we believe failure looms on the horizon. Or so we think. If only one message emerges from this book, it should be the following. You can step up to a crucial confrontation and hold it well. You already do that on your best days, and when you can take it no longer, you try to do it on your worst days. Now that you have a systematic way to think about crucial confrontations and are armed with skills that really work, more days can be your best days. Equally important, when it comes to holding a big, sticky, complicated confrontation, you don't have to leap out of a plane without a parachute. Nobody's asking you to take a terrible and irreversible risk. Here's why. The first two skills, choose if and what and master my stories, take place in the confines and safety of your own head. By stepping up to problems that should be handled and picking the right one, you're ensuring that your effort is worthwhile. By doing your best to keep your emotions under control, you're taking an important step toward acting rationally and reducing resistance and defensiveness. Once again, this is all done before you say a single word. No risk there. Also, these actions alone keep you from charging in and ruining the conversation with your first sentence. This alone doubles your chances of success. You then move from thinking to talking by discreetly and calmly describing the gap. This is the first time you're exposing yourself to any risk whatsoever, but you're doing your best to describe behaviors, not share ugly conclusions. You're a scientist, not a critic or judge. This humanistic approach helps keep the conversation professional and objective. Now, after sharing one sentence or possibly two, you end with a question, not an accusation. You're not three sentences into the crucial confrontation, and you've paused to listen to the other person. This, too, minimizes the risk. You've seen some things, and you're wondering what's really going on. What's the other person's view? What if the other person takes offense or maybe even becomes angry and abusive? You can stop and deal with the new problem, or if you're feeling befuddled, you can always take a strategic delay. Back off and take time to rethink your approach. This is a conversation, not a gauntlet. It has exit points. Let's say the other person responds favorably. He or she doesn't explode or become offended, but merely explains what's happening. He or she is either unable or unmotivated to keep the failed promise. That's it. Consider motivation. This isn't particularly dangerous either. You're not trying to motivate others. You're not trying to figure out how to generate enough power to force others to comply. Best of all, you're not trying to change underlying, immutable personalities. Your job is simply to make it motivating. To do this, you jointly explore the forces that cause the task to be motivating or not motivating. This requires you to do nothing more than share natural consequences and listen for the other person to share any additional consequences you may not be aware of. You don't have to pummel people into submission. You may even choose to back off from your original request if it becomes clear that continuing on the original course doesn't make sense. You too can be influenced. When it comes to motivation, you're relying on dialogue, not diatribe. What if the person isn't able? Once again, your job isn't to force others to do the impossible. By definition, that can't be done. Your job isn't even to force others to do the difficult, not over the long run, at least. Your job is to make it easy. How risky is that? Jointly examine forces that are serving as barriers. Jointly come up with resolutions. It's little wonder that our friend Melissa at the plywood mill and the thousands of other influence masters we studied so willingly step up to crucial confrontations. They do this not because they are more courageous than the rest of us, but because they are more skilled. How about you? Are you ready not to rumble? Are you ready to hold a confrontation that has been keeping you from something you really care about? To give your skill set a final boost, turn to the next chapter, where we look at the ins and outs of several confrontations that are both common and challenging. They are the confrontations that people tend to worry about the most. Chapter 9. The 12 Yeah Buts. How to Deal with the Truly Tough. As we've taught this material over the last 2 decades, we've grown accustomed to people saying, "Yeah, but my situation is really tough. These skills will never work for me." At first, we thought those people were being belligerent, particularly when they threw in words like bonehead and hayseed. But in most cases, the concerned participants were only trying to imagine how the skills applied to their world, their toughest world. If the confrontation skills could help with their worst-case scenarios, they stood to gain a lot. All they really wanted to do was dive deeper into areas that deserved careful attention. They raised the yeah buts because they were being thoughtful and reflective, in some cases highly reflective. And so, with apologies to our friend Stephen R. Covey, we bring you the 7 yeah buts of highly reflective people. And then we add 5 more, just for good measure. Confronting authority. I'm still nervous about stepping up to my boss and openly disagreeing or perhaps even confronting her for not following procedure or causing me problems. I could pay dearly and for the rest of my life. The solution. Before we offer some advice, let's be clear about something. Over the years, we have seen bosses who appeared to be narcissistic or authoritarian to the core. Their very purpose appeared to be to stay in absolute control, and anything that threatened that purpose was a threat to them. In these cases, all bets are off. Anything short of groveling will be insufficient. In these cases, you have a tough choice to make. You need to choose between coping and cutting out. More on this later. With that said, we need to be clear about a second point. There are far fewer of these kinds of bosses around than you'd guess from people's complaints. 90% of your boss's defensiveness is largely avoidable. We know because we've seen highly skilled individuals approach people who others thought were clinically controlling and get away with it. Here's the bottom line. The people we watched get through to the toughest bosses differed in soul as much as they differed in skill. They were masters at helping their bosses feel safe because they were masters at seeing problems from their boss's point of view. It was easy for them to create mutual purpose because they spent as much time contemplating how the problem behavior they were about to confront was creating problems for the boss as they did fretting about the problems it was creating for them. They were incredibly effective at making it motivating for the boss because they had thought deeply about the natural consequences of the boss's behavior on the boss. It's little wonder that the boss welcomed their empowering insight. Although we don't want to excuse self-centered bosses for their impatience and defensiveness, we do want to suggest that if in reaction to their selfishness we become similarly self-absorbed, we'll never have the insight and compassion we need to succeed. We'll never be able to create enough safety to dissolve the boss's defenses. Our well-intended influence will be crushed by the weight of selfishness. This is not a blame-the-victim speech. It is about empowering the weak. If you want greater influence with a powerful and defensive person, what you typically need is not more power, but more empathy. What you need is not a bigger hammer, but a bigger heart. If you can step away from yourself and consider how the problem behavior is affecting the other person, as well as how it's affecting you, you'll have a greater capacity to produce better outcomes for both of you. Besides, people never hammer their bosses without hammering themselves as well.
Breaking from the pack. The people I work with are perfectly comfortable violating standards and turning a blind eye to rules. I usually don't say anything because I don't want to be the odd person out. It's not like you can take on the world all by yourself.
The solution.
The reason you're unwilling to say anything is probably that what you're about to say isn't very pretty. In your view, people are doing what is easy rather than what is right. And in fact, they may be doing exactly that. Nevertheless, if you lead with this unsubstantiated accusation, it's not going to go down well. Hey, are we going to follow the regulations on this, or are we just going to sell out and run the risk of killing some people?
As satisfying as this patronizing attack may feel, it's not going to be well received. People may comply, but you've just driven a huge wedge into the relationship. Tell yourself a different story. Maybe others know something you don't know. Maybe they're feeling pressured just as you are. Maybe you just don't know all the facts. Who knows what they're thinking? One thing is for certain. Seeing yourself as the only one with a conscience or a backbone, and then acting on that story, is sure to make you come across as self-righteous. It's surely going to provoke other people's resentment and resistance. How could it not? Change your story, and your behavior will change along with it. Ask yourself why reasonable, rational, and decent people are doing what they're doing.
Married to a mime. My spouse never wants to talk about anything. I experience a problem with him, and he tells me not to worry, or not now, or I've got it all wrong, or he just turns back to the TV set and says he'll get back to me later. But he never does.
The solution. If ever there was a pattern that needs to be confronted, this is it. Any single instance may not seem like that big of a deal, but over time, the pattern is killing the relationship. So talk about the pattern. First, ask if it would be okay to talk about an issue because you think that doing that would strengthen your relationship. You want to be able to talk more openly and freely about problems. Your spouse seems to prefer to remain quiet. This is the problem. Fight your natural proclivity to focus on the other person. Instead, acknowledge any complaints the other person may have about what you may be doing to drive him or her to silence. Hint: when people move to silence, it's typically because they feel verbally outgunned. If that's the case with you, acknowledge that sometimes you guilt-trip or dominate or hound the other person until he or she succumbs. You want to change this. When you frame the conversation as an opportunity to solve problems the other person cares about and acknowledge some of the things you've done that might be contributing to the problem, you're creating safety. This, of course, is always the best place to start. With that done, don't demand that the conversation happen now. Set aside a time to talk. The other person gets to pick when. One of the reasons important discussions often get sidelined is that the other person isn't emotionally up to it. He or she arrives home from a trip, you've been musing for days, and bang, before he or she can catch a breath, a huge issue needs to be resolved. Choose your time carefully. You're going to be talking about a long-time pattern. This topic isn't time-sensitive. When you do talk, share your concerns, along with your tentative conclusion that he or she may be purposely avoiding key problem-solving discussions. Don't make this an accusation. Share two or three quick examples, and then suggest that this is what is going on. Then prime. Is it because the discussions often don't go well? Is there a way to make sure that they don't end up as arguments? Is there something you can do to make sure that they run more smoothly?
Make it safe for the other person to explain why he or she thinks it isn't safe. Hearsay.
What do you do when you don't actually see the problem? Co-workers complain endlessly, saying things like, "He's impossible to work with, he can't be trusted, and he never listens to feedback." How do you handle hearsay?
The solution. Master your own story. Refuse to accept other people's gossip as fact until you gather first-hand information. When you adopt other people's stories about someone as your own, you surrender control. Observe the problem on your own. Then you can describe the problem in detail. More important, you can own it as well. Rather than coming off as a messenger or having to apologize for what others think, you can address the problem head-on. People deserve to face their accusers. They also deserve specific, detailed feedback. Anything short of this is unhelpful and unfair. And who knows? As you gather your own data, you may end up with a story different from the one that others attempted to induce you to believe. The family version of this problem revolves around the ever-present tattletale. The same principles apply. Unless safety is at risk, gather data on your own, carry your own message. Potentially devastating. What if the feedback you want to give could crush the other person? I've got an employee who thinks she's the world's best writer. She's always begging to compose letters. The truth is that her writing stinks. I don't have the heart to say anything. The solution. If you've allowed a person to operate under the illusion of competency for quite some time, you really aren't in a position to judge whether that person is truly incompetent. You've never held him or her accountable. Begin having crucial confrontations about single areas that could use some improvement. Express your appreciation for the person's willingness. This is something you can praise. Then explain that there is one thing you'd like to see improve. You want to see him or her take the quality in the area you've selected to the next level. Provide clear, direct, and detailed feedback about that area alone. Don't talk about problems per se. Talk about setting new standards. Once the person has improved in that area, pick another problem and work on it. Over time, if the person hasn't been able to improve, since you've consistently and respectfully held the content conversations and worked to test your assumption about whether he or she is truly incapable of mastering the skill, you will have earned the right to have the larger relationship conversation. Way out of line and scary. What if a person is totally out of line most of the time, but threatens to file a grievance if you confront him? And the worst of it is that because of his special circumstances, he'd probably win. Then what? The solution. Resolve to hold the employee accountable. Meet with human resources and jointly develop a plan. Select a behavior that is out of line and indefensible. If necessary, clarify your standards regarding insubordination, resistance, and poor performance. Inform the employee that the action you've selected isn't acceptable and will no longer be tolerated. Simultaneously, assure the employee that your goal is for him or her to succeed. Describe some of the more poignant and relevant natural consequences of the employee's current behavior, such as being stuck in boring assignments and being rebuffed by colleagues. Take care to tell the person what will happen if he or she steps over the line. Once again, make sure that the employee knows that this is not what you want to have happen, but is a step you will have to take to protect the interests of colleagues and the organization. Document the discussion. Watch the employee closely. Confront the first infraction immediately but respectfully, and then start down the path of discipline. Don't be held hostage. Changing your culture. We're making a break with the past. It used to be that people looked the other way when you violated policy, but now we're supposed to hold people accountable. How do you change the rules in the middle of the game? The solution. You can't solve long-standing problems if you haven't let others know exactly what you want. With unclear expectations, you don't have the right to confront individual violations. confront the past, without singling anyone out, outline for people the natural consequences of how things have been. For example, you may describe how saying yes to every urgent demand has caused you to have chronically poor quality and terribly costly operations. As you help people connect consequences with past behavior, you build moral authority for resetting expectations. Illuminate your general vision of how things are going to be in the future with specific, identifiable, and replicable actions. Clarify do's and don'ts. Study best practices. Contrast what people used to do with what they need to do now. Then teach and focus on those specific actions. If you don't know precisely what you're looking for, you have no right to expect it. Only after you've clarified your new expectation do you have the right to begin having crucial confrontations with those who violate the new standards. More than a right, it will then be a responsibility. Borderline behavior. A woman who works for me is always messing up the details. She's not bad enough to be called incompetent, but she's so borderline that you always worry about her work. The solution. Three factors set those who are adept at dealing with subtle borderline behavior apart from the rest of the pack: research, homework, and connections. First, you need to gather data. Have a conversation with the marginal performer about what she likes and doesn't like about her current work situation. What are her frustrations, aspirations, and concerns? Approach your research conversation with a genuine desire to discover underlying barriers, and then see if you can find ways to resolve them. Next, scrupulously gather facts from memory and observation that will allow you to describe in illuminating detail the difference between mediocrity and excellence. This is crucial. Most people are so vague about that difference that they end up using the feel-good, mean-nothing terms that typically pepper pre-game speeches, such as, "Your attitude determines your altitude," and, "We need you to give 110%. This advice may make sense to those giving it, but only confuses and insults the people who were supposed to change. You will not succeed at helping other people understand the gap between where they are and the vague objective of excellence unless you do the homework required to make your descriptions crystal clear. Carefully gathering useful facts is the homework required for crucial confrontations. Finally, connect your homework with your research. Explain how your recommendations will not only resolve others' concerns, but also help them achieve their aspirations. When you can make this link, your influence will increase enormously. If you can show the other person how the changes you're recommending link to his or her own goals, there's a good chance that the person will be motivated to learn and grow. If you can't do that, don't expect the person to improve. Our plate is overflowing. Where I work, our biggest problem can't be discussed in public. We're constantly given more work than we can manage, and then we have to pretend that we're going to do everything. If you express your concern aloud, you're treated like you're not a team player. The solution. Unlike just about everything we've talked about until now, this is not a problem that is solved one-to-one because it's part of the whole culture. But it is a problem that is best prepared one-to-one. Meet with several colleagues, see if others share your concerns. If they do, ask them to share their honest opinions when you do bring up the issue. Then go public. I don't want to be a nag. I keep bringing up the same problems over and over, and my spouse and children continue in their old ways. It makes me feel like a nag, and I don't want to be a nag. The solution. The second time a person fails to pick up her clothes off the bedroom floor, or doesn't put his dishes in the dishwasher, or continues to squeeze the toothpaste in the middle of the tube, you have a new problem. That person has failed to live up to a promise. You are at a crossroads. You can confront the pattern. You can nag. You can cope. Toothpaste tubes and dishes in the sink are the stuff nagging is made of, minor infractions, often repeated and often reprimanded. Nobody ever says,
My wife is such a nag. Every time I have an affair with a woman half my age, she makes a big deal about it.
Big issues, often repeated, are ongoing disasters. Little issues, often repeated, that's nagging. Choose your battles. If the original issue continues to bother you, talk about the pattern, but only if the original issue is worth it. Sometimes the infraction is just not worth the aggravation. This is a toothpaste tube we're talking about. Maybe you should expand your zone of acceptance. If you choose to cope, explain to the other person that you've decided that it's not worth arguing about the issue. You would prefer that he or she not squeeze the toothpaste tube in the middle, but you're not going to bring it up again. Then let it go. Our relationship is based solely on problems. I work with a person who is constantly making mistakes. Every conversation we have is about a problem. I get the feeling that he no longer listens to me. I walk in the room and the guy bristles. How do I problem solve with a person with whom I have such a one-sided relationship? The solution. Get to know people under less strained circumstances. It matters a great deal. In fact, three separate studies conducted by the authors revealed that the single best predictor of satisfaction with supervision is frequency of interaction. And if your interactions are infrequent and only about problems, you're really doomed. Every crucial confrontation starts off on the wrong foot. Others only hear your position. They never see you as a person. So go out of your way to create a wider range of interactions. And when you do interact, feel free to let down your business persona and connect at a personal level. The very first leadership study the authors conducted revealed something rather astonishing. When those who were viewed by senior managers as top performers showed outsiders around their work area, they introduced their employees. They bragged about them. They shared interesting tidbits about their children. Kelvin's son is at the Naval Academy. They had obviously talked about a whole host of topics and developed a personal relationship. Bottom performers, in contrast, showed outsiders the machines and products. They walked right by their people as if they weren't even there. So develop more full relationships. Take people to lunch. Don't have an agenda, just talk. Walk around and casually chat about topics that interest the other person. And when you see things gone right, recognize people for doing a good job. Become a whole person and not just a purveyor of problems. Create a healthier context for solving problems when they do come up. As far as your family is concerned, if you don't take a break from your busy schedules and take your teenagers to lunch, with no purpose other than hanging out together, you'll eventually pass the family tipping point. No matter how wrong they may be or how often they may cause problems, no matter how called for the confrontations, at some point you'll be seen as little more than an uncaring nag. Your motive will always be suspect. Your ability to have a broader influence by holding crucial confrontations becomes severely limited. So don't pass the tipping point. The more often others let you down, the harder you'll have to work to create a well-balanced relationship. I don't think we can change.
These are lifelong patterns we're talking about. I'm not sure that I or any of the people around me can actually change. Reading is a lot easier than actually acting differently.
The solution. The good news is that nothing in this book is new or the least bit alien. The skills we teach weren't discovered on the planet Krillnak. On your best day, you do much of what every interpersonally smart person does. You step up to a crucial confrontation, work hard to ensure that you don't fly off the handle or otherwise act stupid, and do a pretty good job. On your best day, you are the kind of person the authors were studying when they isolated the best practices for dealing with failed promises. You don't have to change everything, just a few things, and maybe be a bit more consistent. Better still, you don't have to change your underlying, immutable, I can't help it if I was born this way personality. To improve your results, you need to reshape a few of your thoughts and alter a few of your actions.
That's it.
There is no need for a full-fledged genetic intervention, and frontal lobotomies are out of the question, save for recreational purposes. To make this tweaking of thoughts and words easier, we have a few suggestions. First, studying this book is best done in pairs. Find one or more other people and share ideas. Develop goals, practice together, and support each other as you step up to new and untested crucial confrontations. Whether you're working in pairs or alone, pick one skill and work on it, then do the same thing with another skill. Devote 1 hour a week for 10 weeks. That's all it takes to bring about important changes. Set aside a time at home and at work when you will talk about issues that normally you would leave untouched. Finally, check out the support materials available at www.crucialconfrontations.com. Download the free material, watch the video examples, sign up for ongoing assistance and reminders. Pick one skill and work on it for a week. Eat the elephant of personal change one bite at a time. This is Barrett Whitener for McGraw-Hill Audio. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is co-published by American Media International, LLC, and Redwood Audiobooks, and is based upon the book entitled Crucial Confrontations by Carrie Patterson, Joseph Grenny, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzler, copyrighted in 2005 in the name of Carrie Patterson, Joseph Grenny, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzler. Published by arrangement with the McGraw-Hill Companies, Incorporated.